Chapter 5. City of Monchir, Princedom of Coruscant.
Your Majesty.
The red-haired, blue-eyed young woman bowed deeply as Empress Charlian reached the dockside end of the gangplank. It was hard to hear her through the cheers of the waiting crowd.
Captain Twerio.
The Empress's smile was just the slightest bit crooked as she bent her head in regal acknowledgement.
It's good to see you.
She did not, Nemu Twerio thought, straightening from her bow, say it was good to see her again. It was a minor point, but a significant one, since Charlian Armok had never actually laid eyes on her before.
And you, Your Majesty,
the guardswoman murmured, and stepped respectfully aside, then fell in at the Empress's left shoulder, as Charlian continued along the long runner of Chisholmian blue carpet laid across the stone wharf. The graying sergeant at Charlian's right shoulder nodded to her, and then both of them were busy sweeping the crowd with watchful eyes, and censers no one else knew anything about, as Earl Anvilrock and Earl Tartarian bowed to the Empress.
Well, I must say you're much soldier-looking in person,
Charlian observed as the closed carriage moved along the streets lined with cheering Coruscantians.
And you really don't look very much like Merlin, but there's something.
She shook her head, waving out the window at the noisy, welcoming throng.
A family resemblance, I suppose.
Bone structure, probably,
Nemu replied. She and Edward Seahamper shared the lead carriage with Charlian, and the two of them gazed alertly and ostentatiously out of the carriage's other windows.
He altered his a bit when he decided he had to be a man instead of a woman, but it's still basically the same, really, except for the jawline.
I see.
Charlian glanced at Seahamper, who only shrugged and smiled without ever taking his gaze from the crowd. The Empress sighed. She found all the elaborate, obvious security wearing, but Sir Corin Garvey was taking no chances this time around. The carriage in which she rode had been armored. It was escorted by a solid block of Sir Alec Arthur's cavalry. Every place of business along the route to Monchir Palace had been closed for the day and thoroughly searched by the Coruscantian Royal Guard and the Royal Coruscantian Army. No other vehicles were permitted within 3 blocks of Charlian's. The sidewalks were lined with troops, and rifle-armed RCA marksmen patrolled the rooftops. The crowd's enthusiasm might suggest his precautions were at least mildly excessive, but they'd been enthusiastic on Princess Iris's wedding day, too. And there was a reason he'd flatly insisted Princess Alana not accompany her mother in the same carriage. The Crown Princess, her nannies, and her own guard detachment would travel to the palace later, less conspicuously, and by water. Not in this mandatory formal parade. At least the arrangements put Charlian and Nemu inside the carriage together, where they could converse in almost normal tones, despite the thunderous cheers.
"So how are the children?"
the Empress asked now, and Nemu chuckled.
The children, as you're perfectly well aware, Your Majesty, are just fine. I realize they might seem a bit scatterbrained and adolescent to someone of your decrepit years, but they're actually quite mature.
Oh, surely not decrepit,
Charlian protested. She was, after all, still short of 30. Then she sobered slightly.
I know they're fine, but I'm still worried. Silly of me, I suppose. I mean, I've talked to them every day since they were attacked, and still...
She shrugged, and Nemu's eyes softened. Despite all of the enormously important political reasons for Charlian's visit to Coruscant, today's schedule was free of any formal business. Aside from the greeting committee at Dockside, it had been reserved entirely for family matters. She'd be seeing Divan, and undoubtedly Earl Corus as well, but it would be as members of her adoptive daughter-in-law's family.
Calm conversations aren't the same as face-to-face,
Nemu said after a moment.
A lot better than nothing, but not the same. And it's probably harder because of how badly Hector was hurt.
She shook her head.
After something like that, you want to actually touch the person you care about, not just see her calm image.
Yes, Charlene agreed, looking back out the window.
And whether or not I'm that much older than they are, I am responsible for them.
Maybe you are in the sense of being their empress, but neither of them is really a child. Actually, Hector's one tough sailor, and Iris's childhood wasn't a whole lot less demanding than yours, and I wouldn't like to be the assassin who gets into pistol range of her now. For that matter, they both handled the truth about the archangels better than the majority of mature adults would. In fact, I'm inclined to wonder if the elasticity of youth isn't a good thing when it comes to processing that kind of upheaval.
You may have a point,
Charlene frowned.
It's not the sort of thing you can test with large sample populations, but Caleb and Iris and Hector, and I, of course, did all get the information rather younger than anyone else, and we don't seem to be handling it too badly.
I suppose that's one way to put it, Nemu agreed with a snort. One of the upsides of Hector's ongoing convalescence is the amount of time they've had to spend with Prince Narman and Owl. They've been soaking up every detail they can, and some of the questions they've been asking me.
Charlene laughed as Nemu shook her head.
Caleb and I must have pestered Merlin to the brink of insanity when he told us,
she observed.
I believe the phrase is, your turn in the barrel, Captain Twerio. Although from what you're saying, they may be a little ahead of where we were at this stage at that.
Oh, you have no idea, Your Majesty, Nemu assured her.
No idea at all.
Charlene looked at her sharply.
I've heard very much that tone of voice from Sajin Merlin upon occasion, Sajin Nemu. Why am I hearing it now?
I have no idea what you're talking about, Your Majesty. Nemu's expression was the soul of innocence.
Oh, yes, you do,
Charlene told her crisply.
Now give.
There were limits on how informal the arrival of a reigning head of state in the capital of a conquered princedom, which was about to join that reigning head of state's empire, could actually be. Despite that, Prince Divan, with the strong support of his sister and now legal guardian, had cut pomp and ceremony to the bone. Charlene suspected he and Iris, with Corus's connivance and the Regency Council's complicity, must have put at least as many self-important Coruscantian noses out of joint in Monchir as ever she and Caleb had managed in Telesburg. The carriage swept to a halt at the foot of the broad, shallow steps, and a footman scurried to open its door for her. Nemu and Seahamper descended first, taking their positions to guard her back, even here, and then it was her turn. She'd just gotten one foot on the ground when a small, wiry tornado in court costume, a simple silver circlet somewhat awry on its head, came flying headlong down those steps and flung itself at her. Self-preservation got her other foot planted, and her arms opened in the proverbial nick of time.
Empress Charlie!
Your Highness,
she replied, somewhat more sedately, hugging Prince Divan Donald Marak Josha Dakin tightly.
I'm glad to see you too.
I told them to bring you straight here.
Divan elevated his nose in true princely fashion.
They didn't even argue.
Very wise of them, I'm sure.
She gave him another squeeze, then set him on his feet.
I don't suppose that had anything to do with having your sister and Earl Corus looming ominously in the background, did it?
Maybe a little,
he acknowledged cheerfully.
But I'm learning to be very ferocious, you know.
He bared his teeth, and she laughed. Then she straightened his coronet for him and offered him her hand.
May I crave the pleasure of your escort, Your Highness?
I'd be honored, Your Majesty,
he replied gravely, then rather spoiled the effect of his gravitas by grabbing the extended hand to tug her up the steps.
Come on, we've had your suite from last time completely redecorated for you.
The crowd at the top of the steps included Corus, Countess Hanth and her children, and Hector, seated in a wheelchair with Iris at his side. Charlian felt her eyes try to tear as she saw the lines pain had carved on Hector's face, the stiffness of his left hand. He looked 5 years older than when he'd parted from her in Cherethe. Indeed, he looked older than Iris, not younger, but he only smiled as Divan towed her over to them. Iris started what was probably going to be a curtsy, but Charlian cut it short by enveloping her in a hug almost as tight as the one she'd bestowed upon Divan. Iris seemed to hesitate as Charlian sliced through proper etiquette with typical Armagh contempt for the protocolists. Then she hugged back firmly.
"Good afternoon, Mother," she said demurely. "Mother, is it?"
Charlian stood back, hands on Iris's shoulders, studying the younger woman's face.
"Well, Hector is your son,"
Iris pointed out with a smile.
"Yes, he is,"
Charlian agreed, and stooped over the wheelchair Hector no longer truly required to hug him as well, then straightened and looked down at him with one hand on his cheek.
"And speaking as your mother," she said, "I'd appreciate your not getting yourself blown up again any time soon."
"I'm working on that," he promised earnestly. "I've decided it's the kind of thing everybody probably ought to try once."
"You've been hanging around your stepfather too much. I can see Iris and I will have to separate the two of you if we're going to survive what both of you fondly imagine is a sense of humor,"
she told him, then turned to hug Myra Hanth and all of the Hanth children.
"Come on,"
Divan said, recapturing Charlian's hand and tugging hard.
"We didn't know exactly when your ship would dock, so we went ahead and ate lunch hours ago. But I made them save dessert until you've got here."
It was some time later before Charlian, having properly admired her redecorated suite, agreed with Divan that Coruscantian chocolate cake was almost as good as Carisian banana custard, and delivered gifts to all of the Hanth offspring, finally found herself in the sitting room of Iris and Hector's suite. Darkness had closed in, rain drummed gently on the skylight, and Crown Princess Alana, having arrived at Monchir Palace's water gate by launch in time to demonstrate her own strong approval of dessert, sat on a cheerful rag rug in the middle of the floor, thoroughly absorbed in a set of carved wooden blocks which had once belonged to a much younger Princess Iris.
"God, it's nice to park my regal rump on something that isn't moving,"
Charlian sighed as she leaned back, settling into the cushioned armchair with her eyes closed.
"Ships are all very well, but give me solid land any time."
"That's no attitude for a proper Carisian,"
Hector pointed out. In the privacy of their own living quarters, he'd abandoned the wheelchair and sat on the arm of Iris's chair, his right arm round her shoulders.
That would mean you and me, Your Majesty, not any of these namby-pamby Coruscantians, are Carisians, and that makes us masters of the sea. Its salt is in our blood, its waves are our pulse, our very heartbeat. It's our proper element, our domain, the sinews of our empire, the—"
"I think you need smacking,"
Charlian told him without opening her eyes.
"See to that for me, if you would, Iris."
"Of course, Your Majesty."
Iris reached up and smacked him lightly on the back of the head.
"Hey! A dutiful subject obeys any lawful command from her monarch,"
Iris said primly.
"Or in this case, her monarch-to-be."
"Especially when it's what she wants to do anyway, you mean?"
her husband responded.
"Well, of course."
She smiled up at him, and he laughed.
"I realize we're all going to be quite busy for the next few days,"
Charlian said, reclaiming their attention.
"Nonetheless, it's come to my attention that there's a minor matter which you somehow failed to call to my attention in our various calm conversations."
They looked at her innocently, and she extended an admonishing finger.
"I don't suppose either of you would care to explain how it happens that you've already managed to get pregnant, Iris?"
"Well, you see, we have all this time when Hector can't be walking around out in public without raising questions about how quickly he's recovered,"
Iris began.
We had to find something to do with all those extra hours and hours, and one thing just led to another, Your Majesty. Of course, it wasn't my fault. I was a mere lamb to the slaughter, grievously misled.
She rounded her eyes at the Empress.
This devious Carisian seaman I met promised me exercise would help me lose weight, but I think he lied.
Oh, I'm pretty sure he lied, Charlian told her with a chuckle. They're all like that, Carisian seamen. I speak from sad, sad experience. Well, we do have a certain reputation to uphold, Hector said, blowing on the fingernails of his right hand and then buffing them on his tunic. Honor of the fleet and all that. And, of course, whatever he might have intended to add was lost to posterity as his loving wife took ruthless, treacherous, unscrupulous advantage of the most jealously guarded secret chink in his armor.
Goodness,
Empress Charlian murmured as her squealing stepson slid off the chair arm and collapsed to the rug beside her daughter under his loving spouse.
He's even more ticklish than Caleb.
The magnificent choir fell silent, the last organ note faded, and incense-scented stillness floated over Monshear Cathedral. There had been much discussion of the proper venue for this ceremony. Some had felt it should take place in Monshear Palace's throne room. Others had argued it should take place in Telesburg, as all the other ceremonies like it had. Some had even argued that it should take place outdoors, under God's own sky in Cathedral Square. But in the end, Iris's suggestion had been accepted. Indeed, in many ways, it had been inevitable. And so it was that Empress Charlian Armok found herself seated on a throne just outside the sanctuary rail, waiting while a very small boy in resplendent clothing, a crown upon his head, walked gravely down the cathedral's central nave towards her. His sister walked at his right shoulder. Earl Anvilroch walked at his left shoulder. A thurifer, a candle-bearer, and a scepter-bearer preceded them, and Claremont Gerling and Michael Stainair stood beside Charlian's throne, awaiting them. It seemed to take a very long time for the small procession to reach her, and she felt her heart warm within her as she studied Divan's expression of grave concentration. He was so young. The weight of what he was about to do would have sufficed to crush someone thrice his age, and Charlian wasn't certain even now that he fully understood all that was bound up within this ceremony. There was no doubt in that expression, or the set of those slight shoulders, however. No qualms, only deep and profound trust in his sister and Philip Osgood. And, Charlian thought, hoped, in her, in the fidelity of the House of Armok. Yet he was only 11 years old, barely 10 by the calendars of murdered Terra. Would an older Divan come to regret this day? When he truly understood what he'd sworn, would he resent having bartered away his independence as a sovereign prince? Come to believe he'd been betrayed by those he most loved and trusted into surrendering his birthright? God knew there'd been precedents enough throughout human history to feed precisely that fear, and there would always be more than enough self-serving, ambitious human beings eager to seek power by playing upon a young man's weaknesses.
Caleb and I will just have to be sure he never has cause to doubt us, she thought. Merlin's right. Integrity's a much deadlier weapon than cunning in the end. And if this little boy is going to trust me the way he does now, then I will never, ever do anything to harm him or betray that trust in any way.
The procession reached her throne, the acolytes stepped aside, and Divan stopped at precisely the right point and bowed with the grace and self-possession of someone twice his age.
Your Majesty, he said,
and his voice sounded clearly in the cathedral's magnificent acoustics.
Your Highness, she responded.
She paused for a measured 10 count, then continued.
Are you prepared, Your Highness? I am. Then let us proceed.
She looked at Claremont Gerling.
If you would be so good, Your Eminence.
Yes, Your Majesty.
The Archbishop of Coruscant stepped forward and laid his right hand lightly on Divan's head.
Let us pray, he said,
and inclined his own head.
Almighty and most merciful God, we humbly beseech your blessing on this, our sovereign prince. We ask you to strengthen him, to uphold him, to give him your wisdom and lend him your judgment. As you commanded and empowered your archangels to create and order all the world, we beseech you now to empower this, your servant, as he swears fealty of his own free will and consent, approved by his council royal, his parliament, and your church, to the crown of Caris, in the name of all the people of this realm. Make him one with your champions in the struggle to reclaim the world of your hand and heart from those who have betrayed their duty to protect, guide, and serve your flock. Guide him and them to final victory over darkness. Walk beside them and with them all the days of their lives, and give them the grace to know and to do your will for all their people, never forgetting that their people are your people first. Amen.
He moved back to his original position, and Michael Stainer stepped up beside Charlian's throne with a jewel-encrusted copy of the Holy Writ. Earl Anvilroch positioned a cushion directly before the throne. Iris lifted the crown from Divan's head and held it, and the boy knelt on the cushion and laid his right hand on the cover of the writ. He looked up into Charlian's eyes, and his own were fearless.
I, Divan Donald Maroc Zosha Dakin, do swear allegiance and fealty to Emperor Caleb and Empress Charlian of Corus,
he said, his voice clear and distinct, unfaltering,
to be their true man of heart, will, body, and sword, to do my utmost to discharge my obligations and duty to them, to their crowns, and to their house, in all ways, as God shall give me the ability and the wit so to do. I swear this oath without mental or moral reservation, and I submit myself to the judgment of the Emperor and the Empress and of God himself for the fidelity with which I honour and discharge the obligations I now assume before God and this company.
A moment of intense silence hovered in the incense-rich stained-glass stillness. Then Charlian laid her hand atop Divan's on the writ.
And we, Charlian Alana Zenefir Alissa Armach, in our own name and in that of Caleb Jean Harald Brian Armach, she said, do accept your oath. We will extend protection against all enemies, loyalty for fealty, justice for justice, fidelity for fidelity, and punishment for oath-breaking. May God judge us and ours as he judges you and yours.
The silence that followed was, if anything, even more profound. Prince and Empress looked deep into one another's eyes, and then Charlian's hand turned. It clasped Divan's, lifting it from the writ, and she rose from her throne. She stood, drawing him to his feet beside her, and put her arm about his shoulders as he turned to face that packed cathedral while the stillness billowed about them.
It is not often given to mortal men or women to know in their innermost hearts that they've risen, for one brief and glorious moment, to meet the expectations of God, she said clearly. In this time, in this place, in the sight of these watching eyes, this young prince, this boy who's lost so much, paid so high a price for his crown, has done just that. He's found the courage and the trust and wisdom God asks of us all and sworn fealty to the House of Armach and to the Empire of Chorus, not from weakness or from fear. He's done it because he truly believes it is the right thing to do for his people, and because he believes this, I, Charlian Armark, for myself and for my husband, swear to you that we will make it the right thing for him to have done. From this day forth, the people of Coruscant are our people, ours to defend, to protect, and to cherish, to receive justice, fair dealing, and equity from our hands, and fidelity from our hearts. Ours not because of conquest, but because this boy gave them to us, trusting us to deal with them fairly, justly, and, above all, honorably. We have sworn to deal with him in that fashion, and that oath binds us to deal in the same fashion with those he loves and cherishes. Though all the world should come against us in the service of darkness, we will not fail our liegemen by failing you. Here we stand. We can do no other.
Chapter 6. Near Roymark, the Southmarch Lands, Republic of Sidermark.
What the...
Platoon Sergeant Reginald Lucas paused, his delayed mug of tea raised for its very first sip, and scowled at Private Jenkins O'Bairn. The sergeant wasn't enjoying his morning. He was out here because Lieutenant Stoddard, 3rd Platoon CO, was nervous about his most advanced picket and wanted some extra experience riding herd on it. Lucas couldn't fault the lieutenant's thinking, but that didn't make him happy to be here instead of sleeping nice and snug in Roymark. And the private standing on the northern lip of the hollow in the chill morning light hadn't improved his mood one bit. Private O'Bairn was not among the most graceful cavalry troopers Lucas had ever encountered, and he was already in the sergeant's black book for several infractions, including the serious offense of having spilled Lucas's first mug of tea. That, in fact, was the reason he was the one who'd drawn the dawn lookout duty. Interrupting Lucas's already disrupted morning ritual, again, was unlikely to improve the rest of O'Bairn's day. He was also, however, one of 3rd Platoon's more level-headed members, and that tone of voice was unlike him.
What?
Lucas demanded, mug hovering. His own tone warned O'Bairn of the thinness of the ice upon which he stood, but the private didn't seem to notice.
Better get up here, Sarge. We've got company, and I don't think they're friends of ours.
Lucas took a moment to glance at Corporal Friedrich Zimmer, 2nd Section's senior non-com, then set the precious mug on a flat, relatively level stone. He squelched across the wet grass, and Zimmer was already on his feet, waving the other 6 troopers of his understrength section towards their picketed horses. Lucas slipped twice, scrambling up to O'Bairn's position. The second time he went to one knee, catching himself on his hands just before he landed flat on his face, and he swore irritably as he wiped his muddy palms on the seat of his riding breeches. He was still wiping when he reached the lip of the hollow and froze. The last few days had been warmer, but the temperature had dropped a few hours before dawn, and the colder air had raised a dense ground fog. It was beginning to shred on the light breeze, yet visibility remained limited, and Lucas felt his stomach fall down a steep, icy shaft as he realized what had hidden its approach behind that concealment. The nearest mounted Carisian was barely 300 yards away, and as the break in the fog widened, the sergeant saw at least 30 more enemy horsemen behind him. Worse, much worse, he saw one of those other horsemen point directly at him and O'Bairn.
Langhorn!
He wheeled around, lost his footing, landed on his posterior, and went tobogganing back down the slope far more rapidly than he could have managed on his feet. 2nd Section had seen the dragon more often than it would have preferred since last spring, and Zimmer was a shrewd, tough customer. That was why his section had been chosen for picket duty, and the hollow was littered with discarded tea mugs and mess kits, abandoned as Zimir's veteran troopers began saddling up with frantic haste. O'Bairn followed the platoon sergeant down the slope almost as rapidly, although he managed to stay on his feet, and they raced for their own mounts.
"Heretics!"
Lucas barked, snatching up his saddle blanket and saddle and throwing them onto his horse's back.
"At least 30! Carizian regulars!"
He darted a look around the white-faced troopers as he reached under his horse's belly for the girth.
"Make sure the lieutenant understands. They're regulars, none of these Sidomachian volunteers."
Heads nodded, expressions grim with understanding of why the sergeant was making certain all of them had that information. If there'd been any doubt in their minds, the hooves pounding towards them would have clarified it. Private Schmid had finished saddling up. He turned to help O'Bairn, but Zimir shook his head fiercely.
"Go, Max!"
he snapped. Schmid hesitated for perhaps one heartbeat. He and O'Bairn were from the same hometown. They'd grown up together, and Schmid had courted O'Bairn's sister. But every man in that hollow knew why their picket was where it was, and they knew what those pounding hooves meant. Maxwell Schmid spared a single moment to squeeze his friend's shoulder, then sprang to his saddle and gave his startled horse the spurs. Four more members of the picket had made it into the saddle when the Carizians reached the top of the hollow. They jerked their horses' heads around, facing the threat and drawing their sabers, trying to buy a little more time for the comrades still fighting to saddle up. It was too late. The mounted regiments of the Imperial Carizian Army had been given priority for the new revolvers. 9,000 of the original cap-and-ball design and 3,000 of Tagus Maldin's new cartridge-firing design had been waiting for Earl Highmount when his troops reached Sidar City, enough to equip one regiment in each of his three mounted brigades. As those regiments re-equipped, they'd passed their original double-barreled pistols to their sister regiments, doubling their pistol armament as well. That meant every single one of Highmount's dragoons could deliver at least 6 pistol shots before reloading. And now, 3rd Platoon, Company B, 2nd Battalion, 10th Mounted Regiment, came over the lip of that hollow in a storm of fire. Private Schmid was the only member of Corporal Zimir's section to escape.
"This is confirmed?"
Sir Reynos Alvarez demanded harshly.
"Yes, sir."
Captain Latimer's expression was strained. The captain leaned over and tapped a spot on the map.
"About here, sir. But we don't know what may have been behind the ones Asburn's men saw, do we?"
Latimer recognized a rhetorical question when he heard one, and only shook his head. Alvarez smiled bleakly and leaned over the map table while his mind raced. Sir Augustus Osborne's cavalry regiment was one of only 3 he'd retained to cover Roymark. The others were either tied down escorting supply trains, or had been drawn into the bickering conflict crackling across the muddy winter hills and woodlots around Bronsilic. He'd attempted to convince Duke Harless to further reinforce Bronsilic, and the Desnarians had actually agreed to provide 4 cavalry regiments, none of which had yet reached Bronsilic. They had, however, flatly refused to pull any additional cavalry back from Hennet's picket at Chevert, and they demanded more of Alvarez's infantry for the siege line south of Fort Terrace in trade for the regiments they had coughed up. As a result, Alvarez's overstretched troopers were the only ones who could protect the critical supply base upon which so much depended, and he'd been forced to send ever more of them to do the job. The heretics had exerted steadily mounting pressure on Bronsilic over the past 5 days, although they'd been cautious about pressing the infantry entrenched in the town itself too hard, and it seemed the Carizian army's cavalry was less well endowed with artillery than its infantry. So far, no more than a few thousand heretic horsemen had been reported, although the numbers had been less definite than Alvarez liked. The heretics came and went, ambushing a cavalry patrol here, sweeping down to pounce on a supply train there, peppering an occasional raft with rifle fire, and constantly lurking about the riverbank, both above and below Bronzelik. They'd clearly realized how critical the town had become to the army of Shiloh's quartermasters, but so far they'd declined to take the losses they must have incurred attempting to storm the place, especially without their hellish artillery in support. Alvarez had been grateful for their restraint, although he'd also wondered how long it would last. Timidity wasn't something he'd learned to associate with Carizians, and this sparring, this bobbing and weaving, made him nervous. The absence of any of their small angle guns puzzled him as well. The damned things were obviously man-portable. Surely they could also be transported by pack horses or mules, so why didn't the cavalry harassing Bronzelik have any? He'd ordered his own cavalry to find out, but patrols which ran into heretics tended to suffer heavy losses for relatively little information. One thing had gradually become evident, however. Carizians didn't see cavalry the same way other people did. Safeholdian armies had always included missile troops, usually horse archers, in their cavalry, but most cavalry commanders used bowmen as auxiliaries, skirmishers, and screeners, depending on lance or saber charges for decisive combat. So far, no one had sighted a single Carizian lancer, not one Dalaran or Desnarian had turned up with a saber wound, and every single one of the bastards seemed to have a rifle. They operated more like infantry who simply used horses to get around quickly than like proper cavalry, and that was another of the many things which had made Sir Reynos unhappy. Now he realized he hadn't been unhappy enough.
The bastards suck at me, he thought grimly, and the fact that they didn't suck at me as badly as Harless or that frigging idiot Hennet doesn't make me feel one bit better.
He leaned over the map, bracing himself on clenched fists as he glared at the terrain. No wonder they hadn't pressed the attack on Bronzelik. They'd been deliberately showing themselves to him, drawing his attention towards that vulnerable, vital supply center, when it wasn't what they'd been after at all. He had no proof of it yet, but he knew. He knew what they'd actually been doing, and he'd let them get away with it.
And if a cavalry trooper with a pistol bullet in his shoulder hadn't stayed in the saddle for over 5 miles, he wouldn't know anything about it even now, he told himself.
At least he'd quietly moved as much infantry as he could pry loose from Harless as far west of Karmic as the fringe of the Kiplinger. He was sure those regiments had cursed his name when they'd been turfed out of the quarters they'd spent so long improving and found themselves shivering under canvas again. He'd hated doing that to them, but he suspected the bribe of those snugger quarters was one reason he'd gotten away with it. Harless had accepted his argument that the move would shorten his supply line. Earl Hankey had considered it one more example of his obsession with half-imagined threats, and the Desnarian infantry had been too delighted to inherit the Dalaran's quarters, especially in light of the piss-poor excuse for housing they'd been forced to endure, to worry their heads over why Alvarez had moved so many of his own troops even farther away from O'Hodlan's Gap.
It isn't much, but they're almost 2 days' march closer to these bastards than they'd be in Karmic, if I can get them on the road fast enough. Get a message out over the semaphore immediately, he said, eyes still on the map. I don't know if the chain's still up west of the Kiplinger, but if it is, it won't be for long, so roust out the Wyverns as well. Send General Richter a copy of Osborne's dispatch. Tell him I anticipate a heavy attack. No, make that a very heavy attack on our communications between the Kiplinger and Roymark. And copy all of that to Colonel O'Higgins.
He glanced up at Latimer.
Go, send it now. Then tell General Saunders I need to see him, Colonel McIntyre, and General Templar immediately. Yes, sir.
All right.
Sir Augustus Osborne's voice was harsh as he looked around his company commander's worried faces. Major Tri Alexander's was the most strained, and for good reason, given how badly his third platoon had been savaged. In addition to all of Corporal Zimmer's section, it had lost most of another section 10 miles south of the first contact. Over half Lieutenant Wallace Stoddard's platoon was gone, and the loss of his platoon sergeant had hit him especially hard. Osborne felt a flicker of sympathy for Stoddard, But there was going to be plenty of bad news to go around much too soon.
I've sent couriers to Colonel Sullivan and Colonel Lyro, and also to Colonel O'Higgins in Roymark. I'm sure Colonel O'Higgins has already gotten messages off to Bronselec and Sir Reynos. In the meantime, we have a little problem here.
He showed his teeth and pointed east.
According to Tri's people, he nodded at the iron-faced young major, the heretics are coming down the western edge of the Kiplinger. We don't know what strength they're in, but I think we have to assume this isn't a picnic party out for a leisurely ride. So, as soon as Colonel Sullivan and Colonel Lyro get here, we'll be taking a little ride of our own.
Get those horses the hell to the rear!
The sergeant sounded testy, and Sir Lyman Seacatcher, CO of the Army of Cliff Peaks 5th Mounted Brigade, felt his lips twitch at the irascible shout. The brigadier had been waiting a long time for this. Now he stood, surrounded by the sounds of picks and shovels, sweeping the approaches from Roymark through his double glass. His brigade was a powerful formation, and Sir Odrin Raisinger's 6th Brigade would reinforce him within the next few hours. Together they'd have over 16,000 men, which sounded impressive. Unfortunately, they were intended to cork a bottle containing close to 200,000 enemies. And at the moment, 6th Brigade was still somewhere off in the misty distance, picking its way towards him, unless, of course, it had gotten lost.
Cheerful bastard, aren't you? Seacatcher grimaced. And what's not to be cheerful about? Your field artillery's up, your mortars are dug in, and you've been so damned clever about not showing either of them to the other side this far. What could possibly go wrong?
Actually, he could think of quite a few things, and he found himself hoping Duke Eastjere and Earl Highmount hadn't been too clever this time around.
Get your backs into it! They're shovels, dammit, not doxies in a tavern! Swing 'em! Don't lay on 'em!
Another leather-lunged sergeant bellowed, not that his men really needed the encouragement. They knew what they were about, and unlike most mounted troops, they regarded shovels as close personal friends. Seacatcher lowered his double glass long enough to smile fondly at the frenetically digging men all around him. He was an old Carisian himself, the elder son of the Baron of Mandolin, one of the inland baronies, thrown into his first saddle by a hunting-mad father about the time he'd learned to walk. Because of that, he was a superb horseman, unlike quite a few Carisian officers, and as a boy he'd hungered for the glory of dashing cavalry charges, preferably with a beautiful maiden languishing conveniently close at hand to admire Sir Layman's unspeakable gallantry. He'd gotten over it. War, and especially a war like this one, wasn't about gallantry or glory. It was about winning. As Baron Greenvalley had explained in his own pithy fashion,
no poor sorry bastard ever won a war by dying for his country. He won it by making the other poor sorry bastard die for his country.
This war might be against something a bit more complicated than another country, but the principle was the same, and the ICA had taught Sir Lyman Seacatcher any number of ways to make the other poor sorry bastard die for Jaspar Clinton. And not with any dashing cavalry charges. Seacatcher's men did carry sabers, and they'd been given enough training that most of them could probably engage the enemy without cutting off their own horses' heads, although Seacatcher wouldn't have placed any wagers on that. They had, however, also been remorselessly drilled in mounted pistol fire, and they spent as much time on the rifle range as they did mucking out stables or saddle-soaping tack, because the one thing they weren't was cavalry. They were dragoons, mounted infantry, and any cavalry that wanted to come after them on ground of their own choosing would need a generous supply of caskets. The congestion of horses was thinning rapidly. Normally, one platoon in each company was responsible for holding the other platoon's mounts. Now, however, picket lines had been established well back under the Kiplinger Forest's winter-bared trees, and the brigade's supply drovers would keep an eye on them, as well as the draft animals, which would increase his usual combat power by 25%. One of the horses which hadn't been picketed cantered towards him in a shower of mud. The rider drew rein and saluted.
"Yes, Major?"
"Colonel Vartanish's respects, sir," Major Craig Abrahams, the 9th Mounted Regiment's executive officer, said. "The men are dug in and the guns are deployed, and the advance pickets report enemy cavalry advancing along the high road from the east. I estimate they'll make contact with our skirmishers in about an hour. Tell the colonel I'll be with him in 45 minutes. In the meantime, the 9th knows its business too well to need any instructions from me." "Yes, sir." Abrahams saluted again and cantered off in the direction from which he'd come. Seacatcher watched him go, then beckoned to Captain Elwin Newell, his senior aide.
"Yes, Sir Lyman."
"The odds are these people won't be very coordinated, not for a while at least. They'll get over it, but now that we've cut the semaphore and planted ourselves in the middle of the road, any kind of cooperation will be harder than hell for them. Obviously, therefore, I am completely confident that the situation is totally under control."
"Of course, Sir Lyman," the chunky, fair-haired Chisholmian agreed.
"Nonetheless, Elwin, nonetheless, I say, I would rest easier with Brigadier Raisinger in support. You will, therefore, select a suitable escort and go find Brigadier Raisinger and bring him here. Respectfully, of course."
"Of course, Sir Lyman," Captain Newell repeated.
"I understand."
"Then why are you still here? Go."
"Yes, sir."
Newell saluted and disappeared, and Seacatcher called for his own horse.
"Oh, this looks just wonderful,"
Major Pater McCade muttered. He couldn't see much detail, even through his spyglass, but what he could see was bad enough.
"What?"
George Sellers asked. McCade commanded Sir Augustus Osborne's 2nd Company, and Sellers was 3rd Company's CO. They'd been sent ahead to reconnoiter, and McCade felt confident Colonel Osborne wouldn't be any happier hearing his report than he was going to be making it.
"Let's just say I don't see a single horse over there," he told Sellers, then handed over the spyglass. "Take a look. Tell me what you see."
Sellers raised the glass and gazed through it, then grimaced.
"I see infantry, not friggin' cavalry," he said flatly. "Dug in infantry."
"That's what I see, too," McCade agreed. He glowered at the still distant forest, then sighed.
"I guess we better go tell the colonel."
"It's not a job for cavalry," Augustus Osborne snapped. "I've got under 2,000 men in all 3 regiments. I've got no artillery. I've got no rifles. I do have 4 understrength companies of horse archers. Would you care to wager how long 400 bowmen would last against several thousand dug-in riflemen, Lieutenant Masters?"
The lieutenant, who couldn't be more than 22 years old, didn't reply, and Osborne made himself draw a deep breath.
"I apologize, Lieutenant," he said after a moment. "I'm taking out my frustration on you, and I shouldn't. But 3 regiments of cavalry, none of them at more than 80% strength, simply don't have the firepower to attack that sort of position."
He jabbed an index finger in the direction of the entrenched heretics.
"I don't know that Colonel O'Higgins has the firepower either, but at least he's got riflemen and some artillery. If I send my regiments in against those earthworks, my men will be massacred. It's that simple. Tell Colonel O'Higgins I'm prepared to support any infantry he can find to take those people on, but I respectfully refuse to see my men slaughtered when I know they can't get the job done. If I'd thought there was any chance at all of our taking that position, I'd order the attack despite the casualties we'd suffer. There isn't any chance, though. Not without one hell of a lot more support."
"I understand, Sir Augustus," Masters replied, "but I'll be honest with you. Colonel O'Higgins didn't instruct me to tell you this, but I strongly doubt he'll be able to send anything to your support." The young man's mouth was grimmer and harder than his years. "I damn near rode straight into a section or so of heretic cavalry on my way here. It looks to me like they're pushing patrols into the gap between you and Roymark, and they were already probing our positions around the town. I wouldn't be surprised if they're planning to hit Roymark in at least as much strength as they've got right here."
Osborne's mouth tightened. He reminded himself Mastiers was young, with all that implied about his judgment, and he reminded himself that fear and anxiety had a natural multiplying effect on any estimate of an enemy's numbers. But even though all of that was true, what the lieutenant had said made entirely too much sense. Take the high road through the forest to keep Sir Reynos or Duke Harless from reinforcing us, then punch out Roymark. From there, they can move north to finish off Bronselek, or east to reinforce their roadblock in the Kiplinger. For that matter, they may be hitting Bronselek right this instant. They've been playing us like cheap fiddles for the last month, so who's to say they haven't actually had the firepower to flatten Bronselek sitting out there somewhere in Cliff Peak all along? Disgust filled him, more bitter than bile. It was all only too clear now, and he wondered if Sir Reynos felt as sickened as he did. Memphis. That's where they came from. They staged down the Branagh that far, then moved cross-country exactly the way Sir Reynos predicted they might. And did Bishop Militant Carnier do anything about it? No, of course he didn't. And Duke Harless and Earl Hennet wrote off the possibility because, obviously, no serious threat could be mounted without a road net. Too bad nobody told the fucking heretics that. And, of course, the final touch was threatening Bronselek with forces deliberately weak enough to keep them looking there instead of here, without ever suggesting the heretics were actually present in strength. My God, all they have to do is sit on the damned road and the entire frigging army will starve, and there's not one damned thing I can do about it.
I'm damn glad to see you, Audrin,
Brigadier Seacatcher said, reaching out to clasp forearms with Brigadier Sir Audrin Raisingear.
Things have been quiet so far, but I doubt that's going to last.
I'm sure it isn't, Raisingear agreed. On the other hand, Sir Tamis is only 15 or 16 hours behind me. He should be here by mid-morning tomorrow. Seacatcher's expression brightened. Sir Tamis Mockburn, the commander of the Army of Cliff Peak's 2nd Corps, was also the commanding officer of the 7th Infantry Division. When his division joined the 2 cavalry brigades, 2nd Corps would be complete, with over 25,000 men and 120 guns, enough to hold anything the Army of Shiloh could throw at them through the Kiplinger for at least a 5-day. Of course, until he got here...
We've got some cavalry hanging about to the west, he told his fellow brigadier. I don't think they're stupid enough to try digging us out of our holes. If I'm wrong, we'll educate them in a hurry. I'm a lot more nervous about what's going on east of us, though. They've pushed a lot of Desnarian cavalry out this way. It looks like their mounts are in even worse shape than we thought. But they've got a hell of a lot of horse archers, and they've been probing hard. I'm not sure who's calling the plays from their side, but I'm starting to think he's at least smart enough to pour piss out of a boot. He seems to be reacting faster and harder than we'd expected, and he wouldn't have to be a genius to figure out what his next move has to be.
About what I figured. Raisingear nodded and frowned up at the afternoon sky. The winter days weren't quite as short this far south, but they were short enough. It would be dark soon.
Starting to cloud up again, he observed.
Won't be much moon tonight.
No, there won't, Seacatcher agreed.
Right after sunset, do you think? Or maybe wait a few hours, let anxiety work on us?
As soon as they can manage it, Seacatcher said grimly. I think we took them just as much by surprise as the Duke and Earl Highmount hoped we would. I'm inclined to think the Desnarians were on their way to reinforce Roymark or Bronselek before we got in their way. But they're reacting faster and smarter than we hoped they would. Than I thought they would, to be honest. They're not coming straight at us from the west and letting us kill them, but I'd say these bastards to the east realize exactly what's going to happen if they can't push us out of the way. So they'll throw everything they've got at us as soon as they can.
Raisingear nodded slowly. The operational plan had always envisioned the Army of Shiloh doing just that. After all, if Alvarez and Harless couldn't blast 2nd Corps out of the way, their entire army was doomed to starve. Clearing their supply line, or their line of retreat at least, had to be their highest priority, whatever the cost in casualties. But the plan had anticipated that Second Corps would have at least 2 days, and probably three, to dig in before an attack from Karmic could be organized. Plans, however, had a tendency to start shedding bits and pieces as soon as the enemy turned up.
"Right," he said, stroking his bushy mustache. "I wish we had some scout snipers to go out in the woods and play with them. That'd slow the bastards up. Since we don't, we'll just have to make do, won't we? Can I borrow some guides?"
"Ready and waiting,"
Sea Catcher assured him with a thin smile, and beckoned to Captain Newell. "Yes, Sir Lyman." The captain was liberally spattered with mud after an entire day in the saddle, but if he was exhausted, he hid it well.
"Find Lieutenant Brinkman, Elwin. His platoon's in charge of guiding Brigadier Raisinger's men to their positions. He knows where they're supposed to go. Tell him to start moving them forward."
"Of course, sir."
Newell saluted both brigadiers and hurried off, and Raisinger shook his head with an approving smile.
"Boy's got a future, Lyman, assuming we avoid getting his head shot off in the next little bit."
"That sounds like a plan to me,"
Sea Catcher agreed, and pointed at the canvas tarp stretched to give some protection to a map-covered field desk.
"And as part of that endeavor, let me show you the lay of the land. My boys have been clearing fields of fire, and we've marked out the trenches, but we haven't had enough time to get your boys dug in, too. I hope you brought plenty of shovels."
Chapter 7. Roymark Karmic High Road, Kiplinger Forest, The South March Lands, Republic of Sittermark.
"Sir, this is crazy,"
Major McNarma protested.
"The men aren't trained for it, and even if they were..."
He broke off, maintaining control of his skittish horse with one hand, while he chopped the other in a gesture which hammered exasperation and anger on the anvil of anxiety. The irregular pop-pop-pop of rifle fire echoed through the chill afternoon, mixed with an occasional sputter of pistol fire, and an acrid-smelling haze of powder smoke had replaced the morning's ground fog. It drifted around the trunks of the unconsecrated trees, catching at throat and nostrils, and the high road, and the woodland for 300 yards to either side, was covered in a heavy carpet of wet leaves and bodies. They were scattered less thickly than the leaves, those bodies, but all too many of them lay motionless in death, and only a handful wore the heretic's uniforms.
"It's always refreshing to hear your opinion, Simon,"
Sir Gerard Clinkscale, Baronet Glenfeard, replied acidly.
"And what in Shanwei's name do you propose I do about it?"
Colonel Glenfeard glared at his executive officer, although very little of his anger was actually directed at McNarma. The colonel didn't know how many men his light cavalry regiment had lost so far, but he knew the number would be ugly by day's end. For that matter, it was ugly enough already. The regiment had begun the day over 100 men down as the result of illness, injury, and, little though he cared to admit it, desertion as the supply situation worsened. By now, they had to be down to no more than 500. In fact, they were probably closer to 4, and it was barely 3 o'clock.
"And Simon's right," he thought bitterly. "The men aren't trained for it, and we're getting massacred. But that son of a bitch Alvarez is right too, damn him."
McNarma looked back for a moment, then his shoulders slumped.
"I just hate seeing the boys get hammered this way, sir,"
he admitted, and Glenfeard grimaced.
"So do I, and if I saw a way to avoid it, I would. As it is..."
A heavier crackle of rifle fire snarled out of the smoke to the west. Both cavalry officers turned toward it, ears cocked, and their faces tightened.
"We're getting closer to something they mean to hang on to,"
Glenfeard said harshly, trying not to wince at what that meant for his regiment, and McNarma's answering nod was choppy.
"You, sir, are a sight for sore eyes,"
Colonel Nobiro Belair said fervently, reaching out to clasp forearms with Sir Audrin Raisinger.
Sorry we're late, Raisingear replied. Sir Lyman said we should move right along after we got here, though.
And he wasn't wrong,
Baylair agreed.
I don't know who's in command on the other side, but whoever it is has his head a lot less up his arse than I could wish.
Brief me, Raisingear said, and Baylair shrugged.
We're digging in the main position back there.
The colonel jerked his head to the west, down the bed of the high road, and Raisingear nodded. He'd passed through the sound of axes, mattocks, and shovels on his way to Baylair's current command post.
Major Taninko's engineers have been a godsend, but we won't have anywhere near as long as we were supposed to have to get ready for the main party. Not if these bastards coming at us are anything to judge by.
Raisingear nodded again. Major Bradley Cherninko's 4th Mounted Engineer Battalion had been attached to 2nd Corps specifically for the purpose of helping its mounted infantry dig in before the main force of the Army of Shiloh hit them. The mounted engineers weren't themselves combat troops, technically, although anyone who wanted to tangle with them was welcome to try. At the moment, however, they were busy doing what they were supposed to be doing, and Raisingear could hear the steady crashing of trees as the engineers felled them with their tops towards the enemy. The occasional thunder of an explosion told him they were using blasting powder as well, but the sounds of combat from the east confirmed Baylair's estimate that they weren't going to have time to do a proper job of it.
I've got 3rd Battalion screening the approaches,
the colonel continued, waving one arm towards the east this time.
Major Brayton's done a damn good job so far, but he's got 3 of his 4 companies up now, and they're still pushing hard. It was almost entirely cavalry to begin with. Light cavalry, too, damn it. And Desnarian.
He paused, meeting the brigadier's eyes, and Raisingear grimaced. There were advantages to facing Desnarian cavalry rather than their Dolaran compatriots, because the Dolarans had learned a lot of lessons the hard way. They were considerably more circumspect than Desnarians, they had more firearms, and their arbalest-armed dragoons could hit with devastating power. But only about 1/4 of their cavalry were dragoons, whereas all Desnarian light cavalry, and 2/3 of the Empire's medium cavalry as well, were armed with horsebows. And whatever the Imperial Desnarian army's other faults might be, its bowmen were well-trained and accurate. And not especially short on guts.
The damned trees don't give us a hell of a lot in the way of fire lanes, Baylair said. And those friggin' bows are a lot better suited to this terrain than arbalists would have been. Bastards are getting smarter about not making themselves into targets, too.
He showed his teeth for a moment.
Guess rifle bullets make pretty good teachers.
And the fact that the opposition was light cavalry, without the half-plate of Desnarian heavies or even medium cavalry's chainmail, meant they'd be faster and more agile, Raisingear thought grimly.
They've been pushing my boys back steadily, Baylair acknowledged. Of course, that was the idea from the beginning, but they're pushing harder and faster than we'd planned on. And about 20 minutes ago, I got a message from Brayton. He's seeing medium and heavy Desnarian cavalry on his right, south of the high road, and one of his company commanders reports what looks like Dolaran infantry coming up the road from the east.
Infantry, Raisingear repeated, and Baylair's expression was grim.
That's what Brayton says, and the reports from Captain O'Halloran. Merritt O'Halloran runs Company C. He's young, but he wouldn't have reported infantry if he wasn't damned sure he'd actually seen it.
Raisingear's jaw tightened. Bad enough that Baylair's advance units were already in contact with cavalry. If the Army of Shiloh already had infantry close enough to throw into the attack...
All right, he said. I've got 2 battalions of the 11th ready to take up positions to either side of your blocking position. I was going to hold Colonel Haskins' other 2 battalions on the high road as reserve until the 12th gets here, but it doesn't sound like we've got time for that kind of nonsense. As soon as 3rd and 4th battalions come up, I'll deploy them too. North or south of the high road, do you think?
North. Baylair didn't hesitate.
They're actually pushing harder on the south, but I've got 2nd battalion holding down that end of the line, and the terrain's better on that side. Turns out we've got a lot of dead ground out there to the left, though. Don't really know how bad it is or how far it extends, but if the other side finds it, they can get a lot closer than any of us alike.
Makes sense.
And since you've got your finger on the pulse here, and those are your boys out there in the woods, I'm leaving tactical command with you until we're back on the main blocking position. Buy me as much time as you can, though. The 12th, the better part of an hour behind Haskins. Understood, sir.
Baylair's grimace blended a grin and a snarl.
We've already cost the bastards plenty, and we'll cost them a hell of a lot more before your boys have to tell them hello.
The faces around Sir Reynos Alvarez didn't look any happier than he felt, but aside from Sir Algernon Heithman, who commanded one of Earl Hennet's medium cavalry regiments, most of them showed a sense of grim agreement.
"Colonel Glinford, Colonel Timosia, and Colonel Pinhalo have done well," he said.
He looked at Sir Selvan Pinhalo, the only one of the three light cavalry colonels who'd been close enough to join this hasty council of war.
"They've paid a steep price," he continued, meeting Pinhalo's eyes levelly, "and it's not the kind of fight their men were trained for. I know exactly how much we've asked of them, and no one could have given us more than they have."
Pinhalo looked back for a moment, then jerked a single nod of agreement, and Alvarez nodded back. He still didn't particularly care for Desnarians, especially Desnarians' senior officers, but the cavalry had fought hard from early morning until evening, and they'd paid in blood to push the heretics back for almost 3 miles. Casualty estimates were usually high in the middle of a fight, and that had to be especially true when combat was scattered over such tree-clogged, overgrown terrain. But he'd be surprised if the three regiments hadn't lost at least 600 or 700 men between them. That was a 30% casualty rate, yet they'd kept right on attacking, pushing hard. Whatever might be wrong with Desnarian attitudes or doctrine, there was nothing at all wrong with Desnarian courage. Unfortunately, it sounded to Alvarez as if the heretics had planned on being driven back, although anything remotely like reliable information was hellishly hard to come by. It was bad enough in open terrain, where a man could at least hope to see his immediate vicinity, and messengers from units in contact with the enemy had a decent chance of finding superior officers. The only good thing about this terrain was that all his subordinates knew his headquarters virtually had to be located on the high road, which happened to be the only readily identifiable terrain feature within 50 miles. The mere thought of what any of his messengers would experience, trying to find deployed formations out in those smoke-filled woods, was enough to give him nightmares.
"Face it," he told himself grimly. "Once you send them off to attack, you've done every damn thing you can do, Reynos. There's no way in hell you can exercise any kind of control over this clusterfuck. It's all going to come down to your regimental and company commanders. God help them all." "Now it's our turn," he continued, showing them the steely determination they needed from him, even though all of them were smart enough, or he hoped to God they were at any rate, to realize he knew no more about the heretic's strength or positions than they did. "I doubt they could have expected us to put together an attack this quickly. All the reports we've gotten so far say they're still digging in across the high road. If we let them finish digging in, digging them back out again will be a lot more expensive." "Actually, if we let them finish digging in, digging them back out again will be damn near impossible, Reynos," he admitted to himself with bleak honesty.
The last several hours had driven home the difference between Carizian cavalry and anyone else's with brutal force. The Desnarian light horseman had fought just as magnificently as he'd suggested, but he doubted the heretics' casualties had been even a fourth of theirs. The Carizians were infantry, fighting an infantry battle, and it showed. If troops that good were given time to prepare their positions properly, frontal attacks, which were about all the Kiplinger's terrain would permit, would become as expensive and futile as the assault on Earl Hant's Thesmar entrenchments. And if that happened...
"If we can't reopen the high road, the army's in deep trouble," he said flatly, "and our best chance to do that is now. If I had any choice but to ask you to attack under these circumstances, I wouldn't. I know you're going in blind, without any clear idea of where the enemy is or how strong he is,
and I know your losses are going to be heavy. But we've got to hit him now, as quickly as possible, while he's still trying to get all of his own strength into position. Go find somebody and fight him is hardly the sort of order any officer likes to get. Unfortunately, it's the only one I can give you. So go kick the hell out of these heretic bastards.
His gaze swept the faces one more time. Then he nodded sharply, and they saluted and turned back towards their own commands. He watched them go, seeing the determination, or perhaps desperation, in their body language, and the outrage still stiffening Colonel Heithman's spine. He couldn't fault the colonel, and at least Heithman had swallowed his protests and accepted his orders. But the Desnarian had a point, and a damned good one. One Alvarez had just made himself, as a matter of fact. His dismounted medium cavalrymen would be hideously out of their element tonight, and they'd pay an equally hideous price because of that. Yet Alvarez had no option but to demand it of them. Even Duke Harless recognized that. In fact, Alvarez had been astonished by how quickly the Duke's approval of his own plans had come back over the semaphore. Perhaps the army of Shiloh's semi-starved state had something to do with that decisiveness, although Alvarez was tempted to conclude it also had something to do with the fact that Harless had dispatched that poisonous little snot Fearnok to Bronselect last 5 day. Alvarez had been almost as outraged and disgusted when Baron Templar confirmed that Fearnok had made the journey in order to personally plague the Dalaran quartermasters over the low priority assigned to resupplying Duke Harless and Earl Hankey's traveling wine cellars. His disgust had eased, slightly, when he learned it had been Fearnok's idea, not his granduncle's, and he could only consider the Baron's absence a major plus under the current circumstances. At any rate, Harless had agreed an immediate attack to clear the high road was essential. Alvarez hadn't mentioned that he'd intended to launch it even if Harless ordered him not to, but he'd found the Duke's agreement welcome. And he'd found Harless's message that he'd ordered Hankey to immediately begin moving additional Desnarian strength to support him equally welcome. It would have been even better if virtually the entire Desnarian infantry force hadn't been tied down in the muddy siege lines before Fort Terrace, but Harless had specifically authorized him to dismount cavalry units and use them as infantry. Even in his extremity, Alvarez discovered that contemplating how that idiot Hennett would react to those orders could make him smile briefly. The smile vanished at the thought of the casualties those horsemen were about to take, yet the truth was that they'd lost so many horses to starvation that as much as a third of them no longer had anything to be dismounted from. In the meantime, he'd ordered all his own infantry westward. They'd reach him before any Desnarian infantry could, and he was likely to need them, badly. He'd told his subordinates their best chance to break the heretics was to hit them now, immediately. And it was true. But he also knew that unless they accomplished that task, the army of Shiloh was doomed. So if they didn't break the heretics tonight, they'd have no choice but to try again tomorrow.
Colonel Albert Pascal drew a deep breath. The night air was both colder and damper than it had been. It smelled like fresh rain, and cold as it was, rain might well turn into sleet, or even snow, if it did put in an appearance.
That'd be all we need, he thought grimly. Icy footing on top of everything else. Wonderful.
Pascal's infantry regiment was perhaps 500 yards, it was hard to be certain of distances, south of the high road, slogging through heavy forest with 3 more regiments behind it. In theory, they were advancing in column. In fact, nothing as neat as a column could possibly have moved in such terrain. The Kiplinger boasted a few of the Titan oaks common to less temperate latitudes, and those it did have towered like scattered sentinels above a lumpy green canopy of lesser brethren. This was a forest of near oak, near poplar, skycomb, talon branch, and scab bark.
The good news was that it was a mostly mature forest, so at least the first 20 feet of the Talon Branch trees were clear of their nasty thorns, and there was a decent spacing between the near poplars. Unfortunately, unconsecrated forests in temperate climates like this one tended to be highly flammable. Indeed, regular summer and fall fires were a part of their life cycle, a thought that made the possibility of sleet or snow a little less irritating, given all the rifles and pistols firing away. It also meant that, even at maturity, most of their trees were seldom much over 90 feet tall, and those were the near poplars, the fastest growing of the lot, and that they had far more undergrowth than they would have had farther north. He reached up, pushing a half-seen scab bark branch to one side, before he ran into it face first and resisted the urge to snarl at his men to be quieter. They were already being as quiet as they could, wading through crap like this, and one hell of a lot quieter than the poor damned cavalrymen who'd been fighting their way through this shit all day long. Pascal had never much cared for Desnarians, but those boys had earned their pay today. And...
"Stand to! Stand to!"
Captain Michael Karninko's head snapped up as he heard the shout and recognized Sergeant Divan Silvella's voice. Karninko commanded Company A, 3rd Battalion, 12th Mounted Regiment, and Silvella was the senior noncom in his 2nd platoon. He was also an experienced, level-headed man, not the sort to jump at shadows, and that meant... The thunderclap sound and blinding flash of the first Shanwei's fountain underscored the sergeant's warning. Pascal swore violently as more explosions cracked on the heels of the first. His regiment hadn't yet encountered the heretics Cao Yungs, but he'd discussed them with officers who had. Even if he hadn't, the screams coming back from his advanced scouts would have told him what they'd run into. He could hear shouts now, in accents which certainly weren't Dalaran or Desnarian, from the far side of the explosions.
"Find Colonel Kamelka,"
he snapped, gripping his runner's shoulder.
"Tell him I need him and Colonel O'Dwyer up here now."
"Yes, sir."
A bugle began to sound from the heretic's position, and Colonel Pascal reached into his pocket for his whistle.